Before we get into today's show, I have an urgent challenge to share with you. This podcast is brought to you by the Ministry of Premier Insight. And on June 30th, we come to the end of our financial year. The challenge we face is there is a final funding gap of $65,000 that must be closed by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help meet this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/give. That's premierinsight.org/give. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, your host of the show here on Premier Christian Radio that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and discussion, conversations that matter. And I hope you enjoy what's coming up on today's show with my guests, Tim Keller and Jeremy Riddell. Later on, after Unbelievable, on the profile, you can hear Moira speaking to gospel artist Kim Mazel. And if you want more info on Unbelievable, want to subscribe to our podcast and see some of the other stuff we do, do go to the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, we're asking, do humans make sense without God? Tim Keller is the minister of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York. He's widely regarded as a pastor to the skeptics, having reached many a skeptical New Yorker through the ministry of Redeemer. His 2008 book, The Reason for God, was a bestseller. He's also actually one of my favourite preachers. I listen to him regularly on the podcast. I'm sure his ears are burning as I say that. But he's now written a prequel, Making Sense of God. It's subtitled An Invitation to the Skeptical. Written for thinking skeptics, he makes the case that our human experience of truth, beauty, longing, love, morality, purpose, identity and meaning only makes sense in the context of God and indeed Christianity. Well, in conversation with Tim about the case for God today is Jeremy Riddell. Is it Riddell or Roddell?
Riddell.
Riddell. Okay, dialogue officer for the British Humanist Association. If you're a regular Unbelievable listener, you'll remember that Jeremy was on the show a few months ago in a discussion. Jeremy is an atheist and believes that in a world without God, we make meaning for ourselves as humans. He's also the organising force behind an upcoming dialogue event between Christians and humanists that I'll be contributing to on Monday, the 14th of November in London, titled Can We Agree to Disagree? So we'll hear more about that in a moment's time. And I look forward to today's discussion between my guests, Tim Keller and Jeremy Riddell. So, Tim, welcome along to the programme. Great to have you back with us.
I'm glad to be there again.
It's great, and thank you for making the time in what I know is a very busy schedule for you. Yet you seem to be able to produce books alongside all your other duties. We'll come to the book in a moment's time. First question, we've had so much, you know, palaver over the US elections. It seems to be all we ever hear about on our TV screens, and I'm sure even more so on yours. Any kind of comments on the way this election is, you know, running and obviously some of these recent developments with from the Trump camp in terms of hot mic comments and all of this stuff?
Yes, I actually think what this means is probably not yet clear. Obviously, what you have seen is what we feel over here, and that is that there's a great amount of dissatisfaction with not only the tenor and tone of it, but the choices that we have. And many people are voting only for one because they despise the other one even more. And so you've read all about that. What it actually means, though, is we've never had an election like this. We've never had many people actually do compare it, you know, to the Brexit vote.
Yes.
In that there is it seems like that there's a very, 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 very deep dissatisfaction with the status quo of the leadership, the, you know, elite international leadership. And that's... So what that means, I don't know. Beyond the immediate thing, somebody's going to be elected here soon, but it seems to me it'll take a while to be clear what's going on. So that's about all I have. And I'm a minister. I'm not an expert on these issues, really.
No. Has it featured in any of your sermons recently, or do you tend to steer clear of
it? No, I don't. Oh, I would stay clear of that. I'm a little bit of like a Lloyd Jones in that sense, that he just did not, you know, he did not feel it was his job. He felt like, I need to be talking to you about things I'm sure of, things that the Bible addresses and not political candidates and so on.
Okay. Well, look, it's great to have you on the show today. Let's just hear a bit about this new book, Making Sense of God. In what way is this different, and you've described it as a prequel to the Reason for God. In what ways is it significantly different from that book, would you say?
Well, even though at the end I felt I had to do it a bit, in the last couple of chapters I would make, I summarize the traditional arguments for why to believe in God and why to believe in Christianity. And I do think there's a great deal of value in doing that. The reason why the people are still making the arguments for the existence of God and for the truth of Christianity is because they haven't gone away, because they still have credibility for a whole lot of people. And so I do put that at the end, but I decided after years of watching people read Reason for God that there was a prolegomena, I guess, as it were. There were more fundamental questions that people had before they could really even embrace the book and spend the time to work their way through 200 or 300 pages. And that was, how do you even decide whether a religion makes sense or not? How does reason actually operate in deciding that? What role does emotion and social impact have? Or is that valid? Should we just be using our reason? And so I thought there were more basic questions that most people had. And I thought I would therefore address them, and that's what I try to do in Making Sense of God.
Well, I've really enjoyed reading it. I think it is a bit of a tour de force. I think very specifically it's aimed at obviously thinking skeptics and thinking Christians. It's not in that sense a light read necessarily, but I think you do an amazing job in pulling out just all sorts of interesting stories and examples and cultural references as you make the case. We're going to try and get to a number of the different points you make, and I'll be reading some extracts from the book as we go along in doing that. Really pleased as well to have joining me in the studio today for this conversation my other guest, Jeremy Riddell, and Jeremy, a dialogue officer for the British Humanist Association. We obviously heard a bit of your background last time you were on the show, Jeremy, but specifically I thought great to have you in today because you and I are both working on an event ourselves coming up soon in Interfaith Week.
It is, yes.
Yeah. Do you get annoyed, though, when people talk about humanism in the same breath as faith?
Yes.
But why are you putting on an event in Interfaith Week?
But I feel that, you know, the action is more important than arguing about the terminology.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, humanism isn't a religion, it's not a faith, and...
Maybe we should reterm it Worldview Week or something.
Or, you know, religion and belief, but it doesn't have quite the same ring. So... you know, I don't think we should get too hooked up about that because most people don't know it's Interfaith Week anyway. What's more important to me is that in a sort of plural society, people actually do understand each other, and that's obviously what the aim of the event is.
And the event is called Can We Agree to Disagree? Christians and Humanists in Dialogue. It's happening at Conway Hall in London, Monday the 14th of November from 7 till 9, being chaired by Nick Ross, who's of course a distinguished broadcaster and journalist. I'm on a panel that includes Andrew Copson from the British Humanist Association, Pavan Dhaliwal, also from the BHA. Chinny McDonald is going to be my sort of partner on my side of the table, as it were, from the Evangelical Alliance, their Director of Communications, and I'll be there as well. And in a sense, we're having a dialogue about how to do dialogue well, really, aren't we?
Yes, I mean, the aim really is to get beyond the, you know, rather sterile, is religion true, does God exist, all that stuff. People have seen those debates, and usually if you go in with one view or another, you come out with exactly the same view as you went in. So the aim of this is to get, but I'm sure we... You know, there will be disagreements, but the aim is to get below the surface and to understand, you know, where do people misunderstand and misrepresent each other, and where can we agree and where can we not agree?
Well, I think it'll be a really, really hopefully helpful dialogue in that sense. If you want to find out more about it, go to the Eventbrite page where you can find the details on eventbrite.com. Search for Can We Agree to Disagree coming up on Monday, the 14th of November. Great to have you in your role here with the BHA and willing to dialogue with Tim today. And I'm sure as we go through your your perspectives on life and faith and so on will come to the fore. And hopefully it won't be a sterile debate. It will be a fruitful discussion, because I think you can have those ones that are a bit of a dead end and no one really has any changes their mind in any way. But hopefully this will be one where we genuinely are listening and trying to understand. Let's get into today's program. If you'd like to comment on anything you hear today, you of course are welcome to email in with your thoughts. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us online, Facebook and social media, Twitter and so on. Give your thoughts that way. facebook.com/unbelievablejb and @unbelievablejb for my Twitter account. All of the links from today's guests, the book, the event and lots of other things from the show page, where you can also leave your comments as well. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And why not subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already done that while you're there?
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So today we're asking, do humans make sense without God? Now, the title of Tim Keller's new book is called Making Sense of God. It's an invitation to the skeptical. Written for the thinking skeptic, he makes the case that our human experience of truth, beauty, longing, love, morality, purpose, identity and meaning only makes sense in the context of there being a God. Well, joining us for this conversation, Jeremy Riddell, Dialogue Officer for the British Humanist Association. And I suppose the thing I'd like to start by asking is whether this kind of a book is the kind of book you would pick up, Jeremy, on average, or if you were given it, say, by a Christian, would you be tempted to read it? Or I mean, I'd just be interested in what you think of the whole project, in a sense, at that level.
I think that I probably wouldn't read it, and because I'm fairly settled in my view. If you're somebody who's still going through that process of discovery and exploring various options, you may read it.
Right. Yeah. Tim, who are you aiming this book at exactly, would you say?
Well, I would aim it at Jeremy. As I say, actually, I write it for somebody like Jeremy, because I read books that, in other words, if you read the book, you'll see that I've read his books.
Right.
That's the point. In other words, I have read all the books that have that perhaps have convinced him.
Mm.
And so I would hope that he would read, you know, my books, which by and large, I do agree. I think you're hinting at this, is even though I wrote the book with Jeremy in mind all along, or people like Jeremy, certainly.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I also am writing books for people that I feel like are on the fence.
Yeah.
And who are not all that settled. And Jeremy's right. I mean, if you're... I'm not sure I would read as many books from, you might say, Jeremy's side of the Jeremy's worldview. Probably, I've read them. I continue to read them because I'm always afraid I'm going to get soft, or not see the new, not see the new wrinkles that
sure,
are coming,
yeah.
or something that I don't realize. And I say, well, I better think that
through. It keeps you on your toes, doesn't it?
It does, but I would be weary too if I only just read books, you know, with the other point of view.
Yeah.
So I'm also considering the persons people who are kind of in the middle.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them. You know, Charles Taylor, the philosopher Charles Taylor, calls them cross-pressured people. He actually says in his book Secular Age that there are very, very convinced atheists, or, you know, secularists, let's say, and there's very, very convinced Christians, and they actually can't really understand anybody doubting their position much. But most people, he said, both non-believers and believers, actually are pretty sympathetic to the doubts. They look at the other side and they say, I can see why people are over there. And those are cross-pressured people. And I would say that most of the people who read the book, both Christians and non-Christians, are cross-pressured, because I actually think that the Christians, a lot of Christians who seem to have no doubts about their faith, probably wouldn't pick up the book either.
Right. Well, that's really helpful, I think, at the outset. Why don't I get the ball rolling, though, by talking about the subject you open up with in the, it's actually in the preface of the book, Tim, and that's what you call the faith of the secular. And you use the word secular and secularism a lot throughout the book. And here's how you go on to define that in this section from that preface. You say here, before we proceed, however, we should should take a moment to explore how we'll be using the word secular. There are at least three ways the word is used today. One applies the term to the social and political structure. A secular society is one in which there is separation of religion and the state. No religious faith is privileged by the government and the most powerful cultural institutions. Secular may also be used to describe individuals. A secular person is one who doesn't know if there is a god or any supernatural realm beyond the natural world. Everything in this view has a scientific explanation. Finally, the term may describe a particular kind of culture with its themes and narratives. A secular age is one in which all the emphasis is on the seculum, on the here and now, without any concept of the eternal. Meaning in life, guidance and happiness are understood and sought in present time economic prosperity, material comfort, and emotional fulfillment. And then just skipping forward a bit, you say, in this book, I'll be using the word secular in the second and third ways, and will be offering often sharp critiques of these positions. I am, however, a great supporter of the first kind of secularism. I do not want the church or any religious institution to control the state, nor for the state to control the church. Well, coming first of all to you, Jeremy, does that cohere with your view of how you might use the word secular and secularism?
Well, if we take those three, I'm with Tim on the first one, and I'm very pleased that he and I have no difference of view on that. I mean, to me, secularism is indeed where the state is neutral in matters of religion belief. It's a level playing field. No religion or belief has a privilege, but there are human rights and there is freedom of religion and belief and expression, providing you're not eroding the rights of others. Where I would take issue with him, though, is on the second one, and I think there may be a difference across the pond on this. Certainly those organizations here who are identified as secular or who advocate secularism, including the BHA and the National Secularist Society, they would define it broadly as I just have. Saying that there's a secular person, I think it muddies the water. I think what he means is somebody who's a humanist or an atheist. And those are the terms I would use. And
you wouldn't tend to use the word secular.
I wouldn't.
I wouldn't.
I think that may just be
a linguistic thing, possibly.
I think it, but it is noticeable between difference between the states and here, I think.
Okay. I mean, would you equally substitute for secular person a humanist or atheist, Tim, in that sense?
Well, this isn't a place where I would want to die on this hill at all. And in many ways, we really are talking. I think we're looking at the same phenomenon. We're parsing it differently.
Yeah.
There are most of the people here who say they check the box, no religious preference, and there's about 22% of Americans say no religious preference. Only less than a third of them would call themselves atheist agnostics.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when you press them and you ask other questions about how do they believe in God, they would say they do have a sense of wonder that there's maybe more to the world than the material, but beyond that, they actually are pretty unable to explain what that is.
Mm.
And so perhaps it's fair, Jeremy, to say that what I really mean in number two is an atheist or an agnostic, and the people who say I'm not an atheist agnostic but I'm secular probably fall more into number three, which is I just spend most of my time thinking of the here and now, and they're not truly atheists or agnostics. So, look, I'm open. I'm listening to you. I'm not set in my ways. I did get that, by the way, from Charles Taylor again. In many ways, I'm just channeling him on that one.
Right.
And he talked about secular people. So, and he's Canadian, not American. So, yeah, that may be fair. And I do understand why, if you're an atheist or agnostic, you'd like to keep that straight. So,
I think maybe where perhaps there will be more of a disagreement between you both is the way that you then make the case later on in the idea that secularism or secular people, let's say, have a faith of their own of sorts. And so, again, I'm just going to read a little chapter and see a segment from that chapter and see what Jeremy has to say in response. And this is in the context of you telling the story of a young academic, David Sessions, formerly an evangelical Christian, who lost his faith.
Right.
And reading on from that, you say, He said that his loss of faith was strictly the product of serious reading and good, solid intellectual arguments. But he now recognises that something more than arguments was driving the change. This was also the changing sense of what kind of person I wanted to become. His experience was shifting, and so did many background intuitions and beliefs, and this made him open to new kinds of intellectual arguments. Today, he's willing to say that coming to a secular, materialist viewpoint is a matter of a new, more or less equally faith-based story, eclipsing the old one's explanatory power. What happened here was not that a moral outlook bowed to brute facts, rather we might say that one moral outlook gave way to another. And you were quoting him there. And then you go on to say, he agrees with Nietzsche that his humanistic moral values don't really follow from his view of the universe. There are many value judgments in liberal humanism, as there are in its parent religion, he says. And you just conclude a little later on saying, Session concludes by calling for secular people to be more cognizant of the fact that their viewpoint is a construal, a way of interpreting reality, and not simply the only objective factual account of reality. So to what extent do you agree or disagree with you know, assuming Tim has represented David Sessions accurately there, with that view that at one level, adopting a secular or type of outlook in that sense as regards to the supernatural is a sort of a faith position?
Okay, well, I'm going to stick to not using secular, but using atheist okay. and agnostic
right.
on that.
Cause, that's fair.
I don't accept that. I think that particular example is somebody who came from a faith position and then moved, so their mental framework was a faith-based mental framework, and if that may well be true for them, I don't think you can generalize that it's true for everybody, and certainly I don't recognize it in my own humanism, and that's all I can speak about.
And would you say that your humanism is in that sense, as far as you can see, a very much an evidential and in that sense reason-based? It's not in any sense that you would call it, use the term faith-based.
Yes, I would. But I think, and I'm sure we'll come back to this, that that doesn't mean it can be characterised simply by saying, well, you know, it's the colliding rocks cold rationalism, you know, and but I think the thing that, and I'm very interested in some, I confess I've only skim-read your book, Tim, but, you know, there's some very interesting arguments in it. I think one thing that was missing from that for me was the acceptance that people, in my case as a humanist, I accept entirely that I, you know, being a human means you have subjective experience, and there are a lot, you know, that's an important part of my humanity, and that experience isn't covered by rationalism, but it is entirely happening inside my head. So, you know, it's part of my experience, my subjective experience. So I think there's a mixed up between subjective and objective lurking somewhere beneath those pages.
Why do you feel you're entitled to describe, in this case, humanism or atheism, whatever, as at one level being as much faith-based as your Christian faith might be, Tim?
Well, yes, we're going to drop using the word secular now, and that's fine. I would say that perhaps as an atheist, I can understand why someone would say, my atheism is not a faith, it's not based on faith. Mm. But I don't know how anybody can say my humanism is not based on faith. And that's, there I'm following Nietzsche. Because Nietzsche actually says that if you have humanistic values, they don't follow from a materialistic universe. And that's what David Sessions was saying. Mm. He says, if you have humanistic values about the equal rights of every individual and the equal dignity of every individual, that does not follow from an understanding that we got here through natural selection, through survival of the fittest, you know, the strong eating the weak. I am happy to unite on humanistic values, and I'm delighted that so many atheists have humanistic values, but Nietzsche would say it's a leap of faith to have humanistic values if you're an atheist, that's all. Mm. And since most atheists I know have humanistic values, in fact, you're not called the Atheist Association, you're called the Humanist Association, I would say, yeah, the atheistic humanism is a faith, because the humanistic values do not logically flow from a materialistic universe.
Jeremy?
Okay, well, I think I would argue that they do, and it's quite clear that people have to varying degrees those humanistic values. I mean, let's take the golden rule as the most profound and easily identifiable one, to treat other people as you'd like to be treated. Now, that has cropped up in virtually every society of thinking people, you know, since a long time before Christianity was ever heard of. From, you know, China, from Confucius to Buddha, Hinduism, it's in, obviously, in Christianity. Jesus was quoting Leviticus, and it's everywhere. And why is that? And I would say, well, the reason for that is because all of these people are humans living in human societies. And it arises because, for two reasons. One is because it is just a fact that we have an ability to empathize with other people. Why we have that, and some other animals have got it as well, who knows? There's obviously some advantage in that. But we do have that ability. We feel compassion for other people. That is a natural thing. And the golden rule is just a construct based simply on the idea of empathy and compassion. And if you live in we're human animals that are social animals, it makes it work.
Okay. Tim, how would you respond?
Well, that's not saying, I would, a value, you know, when Thomas Nagel, who's an NYU philosophy professor, and who continues to not believe in the monotheistic gods, he wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos, and it's in which he basically, the subtitle of the book is why the neo-Darwinian materialistic account of things is almost certainly wrong. And one of the things he points out is value, and he says the problem when most people use the word value, and I do think actually humanists also use the word value, they mean that when you're cruel to someone, it's not just impractical. If you say, for example, well, it's irrational to be cruel to people because then they can be cruel back to you. Okay, well, then that's impractical. Or it hurts me, my feelings. That's usually not what we mean by value. What we mean by value is that when you're cruel to somebody, it's actually wrong. And if the humanist says it's just impractical, then I can see why that would be a logical conclusion. Or it makes me feel bad because of my evolutionary past, then that's still logical. But if you actually say it's wrong to be cruel, that it's objectively wrong, Tom Nagel says you can't account for that, that's a leap of faith. And most people, actually, that's what they mean, even though they...
We've got into the issue then here of objective values, and we're just a moment away really from taking our first break. So maybe we'll go to that break and come back to see what Jeremy has to say on this, and then we'll move it into other areas, because I want to talk about the whole issue of identity, hope, and other things that you explore in the book, Tim. But great start to our conversation here. And we'll continue it. My guests today on Unbelievable, the program that aims to get you thinking, Tim Keller, minister of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York. His new book is called Making Sense of God, An Invitation to the Skeptical. Talking about it today with Jeremy Riddell, dialogue officer for the British Humanist Association. Do join us again in a short moment's time. Is Donald the Trump card or the Joker in the pack? In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we examine the US election that's turning politics upside down and how evangelicals will play their cards. Tony Campolo talks about why he changed his mind on gay marriage. Mike Pilavachi teaches you how to be naturally supernatural and, when the prodigals don't come home, what to do when your kids have walked away from God. All that plus much, much more. Request a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. I've got a real cracker of a show for you today as I'm joined by Tim Keller and Jeremy Riddell talking about whether Humanity, Humans Make Sense Without God. That's certainly the topic of Tim Keller's new book. A prequel, if you like, to his best-selling book in 2008, The Reason for God. This one called Making Sense of God. So we're going to be getting back into that discussion in a moment's time. Don't forget, you can download Unbelievable as a podcast to join thousands of other people who do that every week. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. All the links there, of course, to the other features, articles, videos, and of course, this year's Unbelievable conference on DVD and digital download. We were joined by a range of brilliant speakers and thinkers to help us think about evangelism and how to do it more effectively at our London conference back in July. If you want to get hold of that, again, go to the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, continuing on this subject of whether humans make sense without God, in that last section we were hearing Tim effectively start to break into what something that very often comes up in conversation on this show, the moral argument, the view that, okay, the golden rule, let's say, you could see that as just coming to us from sort of practical considerations, some kind of evolutionary advantage it gives us or whatever. But Tim says, if you want to see that as somehow objective and binding, that it really is wrong to be cruel to people. That is where there has to be this leap of faith. And Tim's view seems to be people like Thomas Nagel do recognize this as having some kind of objective force beyond just its usefulness to sort of, you know, for the, you know, advancement of the species, propagation of DNA and so on. But where do you stand on this, Jeremy? Do you think there's something objective about that kind of a moral statement?
I don't think morality exists out there somewhere. I think it's morality is a human creation, the same as religion is. And I think I don't think you can quite dismiss what I was saying about the golden rule as being something about, you know, survival. What I'm saying is that as a result of the fact we're human beings, we feel empathy, we feel other people's suffering, and therefore we consider suffering a bad thing, and we consider well-being a good thing. Now, the thing where I suppose I depart then from what Tim is saying is that we also live in a thing called society, and we have cultures, and these things that Tim has called values become embedded in those societies and cultures. So we even have, though I don't agree with it, we have the government here was talking about British values. You know, I think they're universal values, the ones they mean. But at the end of the day, these are cultural things which reflect our underlying sense of morality. And but it also reflects the fact that we can still think about our morality and develop it. And I'm sure we may come into it later, but our views on, say, homosexuality and morality have changed because, I would argue, we've thought harder about what the golden rule means.
But there's no objective standard. So if you believe in equality, let's mm-hmm. say, Jeremy,
yeah.
That is just a human construct. It's not as though we should be treating people equally. It's just that it's helpful.
No, I'm saying we should because I'm not a moral relativist. I think we should, but it all comes back to the golden rule. You put yourself in the other person's point of view, and equality falls out of that, the golden rule, very simply.
So the fact we feel empathy is where we get this sense that we should do something.
Yes, because you can put yourself in the other guy's point of view.
Okay. What do you make of that, Tim?
Well, here's the quote from Tom Nagel. I actually quote it in the book. He says, "I remain convinced that pain is really bad. It's not just something we hate. And pleasure is really good. It's not just something we like. I suspect the same is true for most people, but on the Darwinian account, which is, I think, what Jeremy holds, that ultimately we feel that way because we evolved to feel that way." Tom Nagel says, on the Darwinian account, this must be regarded as an illusion. In other words, pain is really bad, not something just that we hate. Mm. Now, he's being a really good philosopher here, and I think he's making a distinction. And he says, yes, if Darwin is right, then we have to be a moral relativist. We have to say, ultimately, though we feel pain is not just something we hate, but is really bad. And cruelty is not just something we dislike, but is really, really wrong. if Darwin is right, and that's where it came from, then actually it's an illusion. And you are a moral relativist. But that's the problem, and that is nobody can actually live like that. Nobody really believes it, which means if you are rationally extremely, extremely logical, then I think if you believe that there really is such a thing as moral value, then I think you have to believe in God.
That's it in a nutshell, I suppose. Jeremy, you obviously just disagree with Nagel, presumably.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty meaningless distinction. I mean, you know, because you can't... the fact that pain hurts, you suffer with pain, is not a... You know, there's not a relativistic view on that. It's a universal view. And it's objectively true. And so seeking to minimize pain for yourself and for others is a sensible thing to do, and I don't understand Nagel's
But is it a
all.
Sensible thing to do because, you know, one day you might need their help and so on?
Yeah.
In which case, it's a survival strategy
in which
more
that
than
is a and that's where the societal value is very, very important, because we're social animals living in
but
highly
it still
complex
sounds
society.
Like you're still reaching towards something that's essentially about this will help us to sort of get on better. It's not that this is somehow embedded in the fabric of reality, this truth. It's simply a convenient way of being able to...
It's embedded in our shared humanity. It's not embedded in anything beyond that.
Okay. Obviously, Tim, you feel that your experience and the experience of others doesn't correspond with what Jeremy's saying there.
No, but let me listen. I'm an oldest child. I'm a peacemaker. Listen, I want to say that I like hearing Jeremy say how seriously we should take humanistic values, that we shouldn't just. And I do. He's also right, and I think he intuitively knows that if you talk too much about how these things are just practical, then they have no moral force. I mean, in other words, they have no social force. Mm. If you really say this is just practical, then people are going to say, "Fine, right now it's not practical. It's perfectly practical for me to be cruel, so I'm going to be cruel." And I do think we can unite in. I don't want to push Jeremy to say he's a moral relativist, even though I think ultimately he is. I actually want to unite with humanists, with actually everybody, and lift up a set of values that we say we have to take these extremely seriously. These are not things that we can discard. We cannot just set them aside. We can't exploit each other. We have to treat each other with equal dignity. I mean, I like the idea, Frank. It sounds to me like Jeremy and I could really work together on all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want to lift up right now. I mean, even though I don't want to keep pressing my point.
Sure.
I don't think Jeremy is. So the point is, I actually like hearing what Jeremy's saying.
Sure.
I just want you to know
that.
Okay, yeah, let's open up another can of worms. Let's talk about... there's so many places I could go here in the book, but why don't we plump for the chapter on identity, which I thought contained quite a few interesting different aspects to it, Tim. For instance, at one point in that chapter, you make the claim that Christianity alone gives you an identity that doesn't crush you or exclude others. And one of the reasons you say that this is the reason why it's the only truly cross-cultural religion or worldview. And let me just read a little segment from that. You say here in this chapter, as we have seen, Christianity has been growing explosively in Asia and Africa for over a century now. It's no longer a Western religion, nor was it originally. It is truly a world religion. What is fueling this remarkable spread of Christianity? A contemporary African writer has an intriguing answer. Lamine Sané writes that Christianity is less culturally imperialistic than secularism. How so? At the core of Africanness is the conviction that the world is full of spirits, good and evil. The problem, however, how can we be protected from the evil forces? If an African were to go to one of the great secular universities of the world, the professors would tell her that the solution to her fears was to see that there are no spirits, evil or good, that everything has a scientific explanation. Not only that, but all moral standards are person-specific and relative to culture, and all moral values have to be self-authorizing. Ironically, her professors would say they wanted to affirm her culture and hear her voice, yet at the same time, they would be taking the very heart of her Africanness out of her. Christianity, Sanna says, took a very different approach. It answered the challenge so that the existing African framework was reconfigured without being overthrown. A reading of the Bible shows that it respects the African belief that there is a vast supernatural realm full of evil and good spirits, but it also tells us that there is one who by the cross has defeated the principalities and powers. It's a grand claim in a way, Tim, to say, you know, Christianity is the only truly global religion or worldview. But you think that's backed up essentially by the fact you do find it on every continent and in all kinds of cultures in ways you don't see in other religions or indeed in a humanistic or secular kind of outlook.
Yeah, I know. It has the sound of special pleading a little bit, but yes, demographically, it is the only religion that is relatively equally represented. So something like 20% of Christians are in Africa, 25% in Europe, though we know that's a little squishy, right, of a number. 20-some percent is in Latin America, 15% and growing rapidly in Asia, and that the other religions tend to not be nearly as universal. So that's a fact. Those are facts. Mm. The real question is why. And the explanation that many put forward, and I think has some cogency, is that Christianity, unlike, doesn't have, somebody said, the New Testament Christianity, the New Testament doesn't have a book of Leviticus in it. In other words, both Islam and Judaism has an awful lot of cultural impact sort of things about how you should dress and what yes. you should eat and all that sort of thing. So number one, Christianity never went there. And then number two, I actually think that Christianity does respect the local culture. It demotes it. It basically says you're a Christian first and you're white or black second. Mm. But if you're black and or you're Asian, you become a Christian, you don't stop being Asian.
Yeah.
It doesn't erase it. It's not a meta identity like that. So yeah, that's the idea behind why Christianity and seems to have a certain cultural flexibility.
Do you think that atheism doesn't similarly have a kind of an ability to adapt and reflect culture?
I didn't mean it. You know, that's not my argument against atheism.
Okay.
But I would say that religion is so deeply embedded in so many of these other cultural identities that atheism might seem a little more culturally. A little more culturally alienating to Asian people and to African people, maybe. But that's not my argument.
Okay. Well, what do you think of the argument generally, though, that Christianity does have this adaptive nature, Jeremy, that has, I guess, fueled its success in many ways?
Yes, I mean, you can make a fine evolutionary argument for that, of course.
Yes, you can. You can.
So, and it is a fact that it is the world's largest religion, although I think somewhere in the book you quoted the Pew Research, and what that shows is the fastest growing religion by a long way is Islam, of course. And that's just because of the demographics.
And interestingly, the other interesting aspect of that, and I'm not sort of getting at you in any way for this because it's just the fact of the matter, despite the fact that secularism is on the rise in the West, or atheism, humanism, globally speaking, it's actually shrinking as a proportion of the overall picture.
Well, this is a projection that Pew Research did up to 2050, and what they did was just looked at the growth in populations and made some assumptions. So although they would say that non-religious, people who don't have a religious belief are growing in number, the others are growing in population more quickly, therefore the percentage are going down. Okay. In like all projections, it'll be wrong. We just don't know to what extent it'll be wrong and in which way. But coming back to the comment about Africa, I think it's very interesting. For a start, that quote rather cunningly elided moral relativism with the statement about incorporation of African religiosity. And I think they're rather distinct things. It is true, of course, that in the past, everybody has been to some degree or other had religious beliefs, because if you don't know very much, it's a very sensible reaction to thinking about the world. But I'm not sure that Tim can claim all of the Christianity that he does claim, because the Christianity is such a broad church now. You know, a lot of the things that are going on in African Christianity, I think, would be pretty abhorrent to the sort of Christian I understand that Tim is. And So, you know, it's there are many different things going under that umbrella. But it is true that given that label, it is being very successful,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess that's a valid question, Tim. You know, you can't claim all Christianity is necessarily good Christianity. Is that fair?
Of course. And though you've had a little bit of humility about it, I there's always somebody more strict than you who thinks you're a sellout and you've sold out. And there's always somebody less strict than you that thinks you're a Pharisee. So I think it's all right for me to embrace all those numbers and say, look at Christianity, half of Africa is Christian right now. But everyone has told me, and I do see this, but there's a lot of squishiness. Hmm. But, you know, it's very different because, frankly, put it this way, I would say that whereas a lot of African Christianity, by my lights, is superstitious, mm-hmm. frankly, that it overbelieves, you might say, in the spiritual mm-hmm. reasons for everything. Mm-hmm. Though I have to say that a lot of European Christianity is substitious.
Yes.
a new word that we coined right here, this is a historic moment, that you're substitious, and that is that even though a lot of people say, well, I'm a Christian, when I press them a little bit, it's pretty thin. It feels like there's like no supernatural element to it at all.
Sure, sure.
And so yes, of course, I think that's fair, and therefore it's a little bit triumphalistic for me to be talking about how Christianity's all over the place when actually I don't like a lot of it.
Yeah,
you're right.
No. Let's talk about though the general sort of Christian view of hope, which comes out in the chapter that's titled "A Hope That Can Face Anything." There you talk about the fact that the Christian view of hope, life after death, resurrection, and the renewal of all things is something obviously secularism can't offer by its very nature. And here you make, I'll just read one short segment here in that chapter where it says, Christianity denies the modern secular belief that we are insignificant accidents within a vast uncaused churning. Rather, it declares that our life is a story and that the universe has a personal structure. And this is because you've been quoting from Updike, who you say, for all his skeptical temperament, comes down on the side of Christian belief, saying, mm-hmm. I have the persistent sensation, he writes, that in my life and art, I am just beginning. So just sketch that out a bit more for us, Tim, about why for you this counts as, you know, a substantive way of making sense of the God claim, that this hope that, you know, I can imagine a Richard Dawkins coming back to you and saying, well, that's all very well, old chap, but the universe doesn't owe you anything. This is rather pie-in-the-sky wishful thinking as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I have to say Christians have an emotional advantage here. I read a book by Luc Ferry a couple of years ago, A Brief History of Thought, you know, he's a French atheist philosopher, and he admits that as you get older, the Christian offer that you will live forever with your loved ones in a heaven of love is he says, there's just no way that doesn't turn your head.
Sure.
I mean, as you get older, it's just, and therefore Christians have a great, how do you say, emotional advantage there. People mm. can't help but kind of wish that was true.
Yes.
And that's fine, because sometimes I think it takes that to give yourself a chance to really look at the evidence. I would say it's the resurrection of Jesus, which gives you some historic evidence for that hope.
Yes.
I read, you know, when I had thyroid cancer and I was recovering from it, I read Tom Wright's magnum opus, is Resurrection of the Son of God.
You could use it for a doorstop, couldn't you? That,
yeah, I know, but you know what? It was
massive.
For two months, I was basically on the shelf,
right?
And I couldn't imagine reading that under any other circumstances. And it was a tonic, even though I already believed it. It was a tonic mm-hmm. because it basically, it's the one place where you could say there really is some historic evidence for this. Mm. There really is, mm. and if it's true, then this incredible offer is something I can take hold on. So that's where it actually became more real to me.
Right. And so that's the sort of objective evidence you would give for the claim that there is this hope.
Yeah,
proof. Not proof, but sure. I mean, and for you, that fundamentally makes a difference to presumably the way we choose to live life, does it? I mean, would it? Yeah. Does it make a difference? You know, to the secularist and the human, in your view, of how they're going to approach life with that?
Well, I do think so. See, for example, it would have been very hard on I think humanistic, atheistic terms to go to the American slaves 150 years ago and give them a case for why they should keep on going, why they should work for freedom. In other words, if you would say, hey, your only hope is social policy, I don't know how that they ever would have been able to bear it. I mentioned this in the book. Howard Thurman talks about the fact that what gave American slaves the hope was not optimism, but hope. Christian hope isn't optimism. It's not optimism that somehow we're going to, you know, build a better world. There's no way that that would have been anything that would have kept them going. They actually had to believe in, I'm going to get a crown someday.
There would be a day of justice.
Right. And that's hope. That's not optimism.
Right.
Because optimism means optimism about human ability to bring about justice. And if that's all that they were relying on, they wouldn't have made it.
Okay. Just pass this over to you now, Jeremy. Tim says it's obviously an emotional advantage for the Christian to believe in a future hope, the renewal of all things, the putting right of everything. Do you just see that, though, as a kind of wishful thinking as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, obviously, you know, just because something is nice and comforting doesn't mean it's true. And, you know, you could argue on the slave thing that story was a great way to keep people willing to not to rebel from their slave condition because, they had a promise which was never going to be delivered. So, you know, I think that cuts both ways. At the end of the day, I don't see that not believing in life after death, which is what we're talking about, is a hopeless thing, because people do have, it's a fact that people, and I'm one of them, are hopeful for tomorrow, yet we don't believe that anything's going to happen after we die. It's just that's a fact that people do that.
Does that mean you're optimistic in that sense? Are you a naturally optimistic person?
I'm naturally optimistic, but I think it's a natural, you know, a hope springs eternal. You know, it's just a fact that humans work that way, and that's because. If you don't have that, you become depressed and
Tim says is he thinks that hope within the Christian worldview has been the driving force that has meant people have pressed on and done things that they wouldn't have otherwise really had any reason to do or on the evidence in front of them they wouldn't have kind of persisted. You know, I'm guessing people like Martin Luther King and others Tim would include in this, that his faith and his belief in a day when God would, you know, bring that hope was what drove him forward in the face of, I'm sure, huge pressure. But
I'm sure, you know, that there are, you don't need to be a Christian to have done great things as a historical figure. So, you know, I'd say he's doing that because he was a great human being. And I think for him, his faith was hugely important to him, and it was a significant driver. And I don't think you should take it away from that. But what I'm saying is that the faith wasn't a unique thing that is a prerequisite for people doing remarkable things like Martin Luther King.
What do you say to that, Tim?
Well, you already hinted at it. I don't think his faith is incidental. I mean, of course, and I heard Jeremy say it wasn't incidental, but. But when Martin Luther King Jr., who definitely was an heir of those American slaves, when he says in the letter from Birmingham Jail, the only way for me to know which laws are just and unjust is because there's an eternal law. See, down there we're back to the moral argument, I guess. But the white ministers wrote him and said, how can you, a minister, how could you countenance civil disobedience? How could you? These laws that are here in Alabama were voted in. They were democratic. They were perfectly legitimate. And for you to call for civil disobedience is going to upend the entire social order. How dare you say that this law, these laws don't have to be obeyed, and these laws do have to be obeyed? And at that point, I think. What Martin Luther King Jr. is doing is he's bringing the future hope into the present and saying someday justice will be done, but even now, because of the law of God, we know which things are just and which things are unjust. Otherwise, he kind of says, I wouldn't know. And you're right. I would just say power makes, right, might makes right. But because I believe in a future hope and an eternal law, might doesn't make right. So That's, I don't know how you say that his greatness was just he was a great human being. Well, it really was so crucial to his greatness, that's all.
I mean, but otherwise, I mean, I think Jeremy is making the point, there have been other people who have done great things, not necessarily who have been Christians or people of faith.
Yeah.
So it's not a prerequisite, he's saying, to strive and to you know, against the odds, see a better world.
No. I guess the problem is, it sounds to me like greatness has become this abstraction, and Martin Luther King, just he was great anyway, and he found, it sounds like it's saying he found a religious reason to be great. But he would have been great anyway, because you can be great without religion. I don't know that entity exists out there, frankly. My guess is that your greatness comes from some kind of beliefs, and those beliefs are always in some kind of moral objective value. And so I guess I'm pushing back on the idea that greatness somehow exists apart from these specific beliefs. I don't think there is an abstract Platonic idea of greatness that exists apart from those.
Would it make any difference to you? I mean, I'd be interested in the question Tim asked earlier for you, Jeremy. Would you like it to be true that there's an afterlife and a righting of all wrongs and a kind of a future hope that Christians talk of? Or would that not in any way kind of be particularly...
I'm cautious of the law of unforeseen consequences of eternity stretching ahead, and, you know, how does that feel? I'm not sure about that, to be honest. But because I don't think it's true, I don't spend any time thinking about it.
Sure, sure. But you've never felt particularly like, I wish that could be true? I mean...
No, because I mean we're really talking about death here, aren't we?
Yeah,
that's what we and so if we think of, I don't know, let's take, my father died about 15 years ago, and so, you know, I think he's just dead. He's not around anymore, but he lives on all the time. Every day things happen, and, you know, I thought, what would he have said about that? Comes into my mind. He's living in my memory and in other people's memory, and I don't think that's a terrible thing. I think he had he was in his 80s and he died, and he had a good life, and I have good memories of him, and I don't think that's a terribly tragic
thing. It wouldn't
add
anything to think that there might be a future kind of beyond this life.
I don't think it does.
Okay. We'll come back to you, Tim. You might want to chip in on that in a moment's time, but we're going to another break, and we'll have final 5 or 10 minutes to start wrapping up the conversation, which has been really interesting today. We're asking today on Unbelievable, do humans make sense without God? That's the subject of Tim Keller's new book, Making Sense of God. And I hope you can join us for the final part of today's discussion alongside Jeremy Riddell, Dialogue Officer for the British Humanist Association. Be back in a couple of moments' time.
Are science and God really in conflict? For more than a century, prominent biologists such as Richard Dawkins have asserted that Darwinian biology confirms an atheist worldview. They say science disproves God, undercuts human uniqueness, and erodes traditional ethics. However, did you know that there's now growing evidence from biology that points beyond a materialist worldview? To explore these new developments, you're invited to join other Christian leaders and scientists in Cambridge on the 12th of November for Beyond Materialism, Biology for the 21st Century. For conference tickets and more info, visit c4id.org.uk.
Welcome back to the final part of today's programme. We'll be concluding our discussion between Tim Keller and Jeremy Riddell in a moment's time. Today, no feedback. We're making room for an interview with Carl Faze. He's going to be with me talking about his new DVD and online resource, Jesus the Game Changer. Find out all about that soon. Of course, if you want apologetics resources, the Unbelievable website is also a good place to go. You can find today's programme there, leave your comments and so on, ways to get in touch as well as features, blogs, interviews, videos, and of course links to this year's Unbelievable Conference on DVD, also available as a digital download. Over 12 hours of material to avail yourself of on the DVD and audio CD. If you haven't had a look yet, why not go along there, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Perhaps a suitable Christmas present for someone who's looking to increase their engagement with non-Christians. Next week on the programme, we're going to be hearing the first of two shows where I speak to N.T. Wright, Tom.
Tom Wright, as he's colloquially known. And in the first of two shows, he's going to be taking your questions. You sent in a lot of questions via email and social media for Tom to answer. He's a renowned Bible scholar, of course. And so we're going to be sitting down to look through some of the many questions you asked and find out a bit more about Tom himself. That's in advance of another show where he'll also be discussing and debating his new book on the atonement as well. So two shows to look forward to over the next couple of weeks.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So time for the final part of this conversation. And we're asking, do humans make sense without God? Tim Keller's new book is on this theme. His book, The Reason for God, was a bestseller, of course, getting along for, I guess, 8 years ago or so. But his new book is a prequel to it, Making Sense of God, An Invitation to the Skeptical. If you want more info on the book, on Tim, on Redeemer Presbyterian Church, where he's minister, do go to the website. Today's show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Also joined in the studio by Jeremy Riddell, who's our dialogue partner for today. And that's quite appropriate because he is the dialogue officer for the British Humanist Association and is one of the driving forces behind an upcoming dialogue event that you might want to come along to if you're in or around the London area. Monday, the 14th of November, titled Can We Agree to Disagree? It's a conversation between Christians and humanists. I'll be on the panel myself, being chaired by Nick Ross. If you want more info, again, links from today's show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We've had a really good discussion today on different aspects and really just dipping in and out of a few bits of Tim Keller's new book. But one sort of major theme that we haven't really touched on in any detail, and we've only got 10 minutes or so to do so now, but is the idea of transcendence. So, Tim, do you want to kind of lead off on how for you, and this covers a wide range of things, but the sense that humans often have of there being a transcendent dimension to life when we see that painting, experience that music, consider that scenery, that we're seeing, right, we're, something is going on beyond neurons firing, creating certain emotions through chemicals being produced. What for you is the, how does that speak into the case for God?
Well, Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, makes a big deal about what he calls the experience of fullness. Mm. There's been a lot of debate about his use of that term. He insists it's not an experience. He believes it's the way most people actually live life, that there is more to life than the present material state of things. Mm. And he thinks it does come through sometimes in aesthetic experiences, which can be, you know, that can be actually explained through neural synapses firing in certain ways. But he thinks there's more to it than that. And when I was writing the book, I was surprised at how many people who maintain the term atheist, they still say, like Barbara Ehrenreich, written a book called Living with a Wild God, describes the fact that when she was a teenager, she had some overwhelming experience of something beyond this material world. And she says, she's so unhappy with religion, she refuses to go there. She still calls herself an atheist, but she calls herself a chastened atheist.
Right.
And I relate that in the book. And I was really surprised how many, if I pressed, Vaclav Havel had some experiences like this. A number of other people did. And actually, I never did. Mm. I became a Christian in my 20s more through a rational process, and my experiences of transcendence have been after my
right
conversion. And I've always I didn't think it was all that possible before, but my own research shows me it does seem like there's an awful lot of people who maintain their unbelief and still say, no, there really is something out there. There's something more than this material world. So.
And you put that in the book in the sense that if that is the case, then people have to, if you like, logically ask, well, can you continue to call yourself or support a view that there is nothing supernatural when you have these experiences which seem to rub against that?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Have you ever had a transcendental type of experience in that way, Jeremy?
Yes, I have, actually.
Go on, then. Tell us about it.
And I know several other humanists would say the same thing. In fact, there's a book called The Book of Atheist Spirituality by André-Comte Sponville, a French atheist. And also lesser, not the peak things, but the, you know, the slow movement of a Beethoven symphony and all of those artistic things.
What gave you your moments?
It was just one of those random things, walking down sunlight through the trees, and you know, and suddenly you think, wow, you know, there's something fantastic. But I never for a moment associate. I just thought that was a wonderful experience. It's part of being a human that people have those experiences from time to time. I didn't for a moment associate that with anything religious, and I still don't. I think it's that sense that there's a big difference between belief in the reality of something being out there and the experience of being part of something bigger. You know, a great film can give you the sense of being part of something bigger.
I mean, very often I think I come across humanists and atheists who almost substitute the word God for the universe, saying, you know, I felt at one with the universe, or there's that sense of being part of something bigger, I mm-hmm. think people experience, but maybe then they're no longer willing to attribute it to God or a supernatural.
Yeah, I think that was going on in my head.
I mean, what is that fair enough, Tim? Is there any reason why Jeremy should consider these what he would term transcendent experiences as being more than just this sense of connectedness with the universe?
Well, I do think it moves him just a little bit toward me.
Okay.
Because if the universe is really more than just, it seems like he's saying, I experience, or it seems like most folks, like Barbara Ehrenreich, who maintain themselves as atheists, will still say, but I realize there's more to the universe than what the scientists can find. There's something more to it than what we can analyze in a test tube. And I think Tom Nagel is getting there, too, where he's trying to say there's got to be something more to the universe than just the natural or just the exact, you know, just the, what the scientists can discern. You're moving maybe toward pantheism, maybe toward an Eastern approach, which means I actually do think it's a step toward religion of some kind.
Well, I think you're ascribing something to me that I'm not saying. I'm saying that was going on inside my head. So I think what I'm saying is these things are a manifestation of subjective experience, which is just being a conscious human being.
At the end of the day, in that sense, it's all still reducible, as far as you're concerned, to synapses firing, chemicals, and the feelings those produce in your bodily organs.
Yes,
basically.
But it's rather like saying there's a big difference between the analysing your brain when you hit your hand with a hammer and the feeling of hitting your hand with a hammer.
Right. So there's a qualitative difference?
There's a subject. There's a difference between objective and subjective.
Right. I guess what my question then, Jeremy, is when you have these experiences, is it that it's simply I feel mm-hmm. that way about it, but I know that it really is just something
yes.
that's very much, I could give you a scientific account for what that
yes.
thing is.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So in that sense,
it's a human
right.
feature.
Yeah. And why for you, Tim, is the scientific account not adequate to explain those moments of transcendence, which seem to be universally shared between people?
Well, now you're getting into Tom Nagel wrote a book called What Is It Like to Be a Bat?
Mm.
And he wrote it back in the 70s. And he actually talked about self-consciousness. He says, he doesn't think animals have this. He says, you have, I'm trying to remember how he puts it. He basically says, he thinks that animals generally probably don't know what it's like to be them, to be a bat. They probably
okay.
just are a bat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In other words,
they don't have that self-reflection that we have.
They don't have the ability to say there's something it's like to be a bat. They probably are just a bat.
Mm.
Whereas human beings, we have this self-consciousness. Mm. And then sometimes this consciousness of even something even greater. Tom Nagel says, I don't know how you say that just comes from the brain. In fact, at this point, I know a lot of scientists say eventually we're going to figure out how the brain produces that. But right now, we don't know. And he thinks that's another thing that's difficult for materialism to account for. So, Barbara Ehrenreich says the same thing that Jeremy says. It's probably in her head. And yet, it just makes her doubt a little bit. That's all. And I guess I would hope that Jeremy might occasionally just those experiences make him doubt his worldview a little teeny bit, just a teeny bit.
I often have things thrown at me which make me consider, question, even doubt the Christian worldview. None of them have moved me to reject it. Do you ever get things that do make you doubt atheism, Jeremy?
No.
Never? You're absolutely certain?
I mean, I think, the famous Richard Dawkins scale of seven, and he's not a seven on the scale because he always says as a scientist, you should allow if there was evidence he changed his mind. And I'd like to think I'm in that position. But, I don't find any reason to look for anything else, no.
Right. Because it sounds like what you're saying, Tim, is in the end you feel Jeremy's position is, in a sense, faith-based, that his view that everything he experiences, including those transcendent experiences, can be reduced to a physical, condition. But for you, that's still a kind of a sort of a faith because we're the book's still open as to whether we could come to a conclusion on that.
Perhaps. I mean, I would put it this way. You can't prove a worldview. A worldview is a comprehensive view of life. You can't prove it. I don't believe you can prove it. Science could never prove a miracle, because if there is such a thing as a supernatural world, miracles would by definition not be repeatable. And science could only ever establish something that's repeatable. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if there was a supernatural world, science couldn't know about it. Mm. And therefore, ultimately, to say there is no supernatural world is a philosophical statement, at least. I'll put it that way. If you don't want to call it an act of faith, it's a philosophical statement. Mm. And if that's the case, then Jeremy has a worldview, and it's very consistent. He whatever comes to it, he's able to account for it on the basis of his worldview. But I don't think the worldview itself is something that he could prove, and therefore, ultimately, he's basing his view of things on faith, I think.
Okay. Jeremy, final thoughts as we start to close out?
I'd say that I think you should base what you believe on evidence, and I don't see any evidence for Tim's worldview.
Right, but you do see evidence for your worldview, as far as you're concerned.
As best as we can, but we there's a lot we don't know.
Right. Would you agree with that final statement from Jeremy, Tim, that you should base whatever you believe in on evidence?
That's W.K. Clifford, right? The ethics of belief, which is you should never believe anything except on evidence. But right now, I know almost no professional philosopher that believes that approach to knowledge works, because everybody bases their life on things that aren't, that can't be proven. So even to say I think things have to be based on evidence is a worldview. You can't prove that, because you there's no way to say that statement, that there's evidence for that statement.
So even the statement itself, you should only believe things on the basis of evidence, can't itself be based. It's a kind of self-defeating statement.
That's we're into the Monty Python, what do I mean by what do I mean? I'm afraid I that's where philosophy doesn't help us live our lives, I don't think.
We're just getting hotted up now, and we have to call a close to it. But that's maybe we could do a round two at some point. Hey, look, it's been really fun. Thank you very much both for being such good sports, coming on and discussing this. Tim, all the very best for your very busy life. But I hope the book is picked up by lots of people, both skeptics and Christians alike. If you want more details about the book, go to the website, and you can find out more about Tim as well and other shows that he's contributed to over the years here on Unbelievable. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Also the place to find links to this upcoming dialogue event that's happening between the British Humanist Association and us here at Premier Christian Radio on Monday, the 14th of November. For the meantime, thank you both, Tim and Jeremy, for being with me on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
It's my great pleasure to be joined on the show now by Carl Faes. He's joining me to talk about a new DVD and study course that his organisation, Olive Tree Media, have been working on, now available. It's called Jesus the Game Changer. Let's hear a little bit of a sneak preview of what it's like.
In many countries and communities today, religion is believed to be irrelevant, even dangerous, and something to be feared. What people failed to grasp is that the values Western democracies are built on come from the teaching of Jesus. Values such as the equality of all people, education for everyone, humility and service in leadership.
I would say the world is completely different because of Jesus, his death and his resurrection.
He's showing us what it means to be human.
And there's people who are intrigued by this. They get woke up, they're dissatisfied, they're hungry, they're thirsty, they're restless. And they say, I think I will give him a try. I think I will try to do what he says.
There you go. Jesus the Game Changer, available now, jesusthegamechanger.com. Carl Faes, who's the man behind this new project, joins me in studio to tell us a little bit about it. Carl, welcome back to my studio here in the UK.
It's good to be on your show. It's good to be in the UK and on a wonderful show that's played across the world. The series really is responding to the idea that Christian faith is actually a negative influence on our world.
Mm, yeah, I mean, the last thing you did was this Towards Belief set of DVDs and looking at some of those big issues in Christianity. This zones in specifically on the person of Jesus Christ. Why particularly did you feel this was the next natural stage to go to?
When we did Towards Belief, we were looking to diffuse the belief blockers of our time, so all the big questions. This, I think, is kind of, if to use a phrase, the new frontier almost. This is the kind of place where Christians are feeling like their faith and the faith in the person of Jesus is being dragged out of the public square. We shouldn't be in television. We shouldn't be in media. We shouldn't be in schools and education. And somehow it's just quarantined off into a personal part of our life. And yet what we're failing to understand is that the foundational assumptions and ideas and values of Western democratic nations didn't just kind of come out of the ether and the air. They actually came from somewhere. And those values came from the person of Jesus. So we're reminding people where our key values came from and reminding people that the values that most people hold to in Western democracies, like that we're all equal, like we should care for people, like that women have a place of real dignity and worth within the community. Those ideas didn't exist before Jesus.
Yeah, but I often do encounter skeptics who say, these values are not somehow intrinsic just to Christians. We would have kind of gotten there whether or not Christianity had been in the scene. It's just the development of society and culture over time. These kind of values naturally drop out of things. You don't quite agree with that?
Well, I mean, that's a theory that's hard to debunk, really, yeah. Isn't it? It's a bit like, well, we would have got there anyway. Yeah. Well, the fact was we hadn't by the time of Jesus. And even if you look around the world now, societies that are built on other philosophical religious positions aren't there. We filmed in India. We interviewed Vishal Mangalwadi, who's an academic author, researcher in India. We interviewed Jossi Chacko, who runs a ministry called Empart in India. And both of them talk about the fact that now, today, in Indian society, built on a Hindu philosophy, it's not that they don't care for people, and it's not that they don't care for their families, but there's this structural inequality that they're quite relaxed with. And so, yeah, I guess skeptics can argue that we would have got there anyway, but there are cultures that haven't. And before the person of Jesus, they hadn't. And so this is an outworking of Jesus' teaching.
And do you think that that's historically kind of verifiable in a way that specifically the Judeo-Christian culture that Christianity ushered in, the person of Jesus was behind, can be shown to have made that kind of difference?
Yes, I think so, for a whole bunch of writings. But one of the people we didn't interview, which is kind of a bit like saying, this is a great
the
person.
One that got away.
The one that got away. We were in London, and Larry Seedentop was unwell, and he just couldn't do the interview. Now, Seedentop has released a book just in the last couple of years called Inventing the Individual. And basically a secular author out of Oxford University, Niebuhr College. He's written this book that starts with the Roman family pre-Jesus, pre-Roman times, really, the family, then goes through and talks about the development of cities around families and the gods that were around that, and then demonstrates not just at the point of Jesus and Paul and Augustine, but kind of basically walks through history century by century, demonstrating that how what Jesus and Paul taught about the individual actually gave the foundation for modern Western democratic societies, even modern Western liberal thought. Mm. And he basically continues to push back and say, if you look back at Paul, the teaching of Jesus and Paul, what Paul said coming out of Jesus, that gives us our foundation.
Yeah.
Inventing the individual, I would encourage any person of faith or skeptic to read it, because it's a very scholarly, well thought out, excellent read.
And it feels like you're tapping into something that generally we're seeing a little bit of a pushback from historians like Rodney Stark, like Tom Holland. I don't know if you are a Tom Holland here in the UK, but he's I just read his a kind of a popular historian. He's done Channel 4 documentaries and so on, but recently wrote in the New Statesman about his conversion back to Christianity because of seeing the way that it changed history and how distinct it was from the other options that were available in the ancient world.
Yeah, and Rodney Stark, we did interview, and he's just an outstanding guest. And his writer's written 40 books and started as a sociologist researcher. One of the people we interviewed from here in the UK is Jonathan Hill. Now, Jonathan Hill is at Exeter University. It's a little kind of odd because he's in the theology department, but he wouldn't call himself a Christian.
Mm.
But he has written a book called What Has Christianity Ever Done For Us? Which sounds like a negative title. But the whole book basically is saying exactly the same as what Rodney Stark says. In some ways, he's almost like a younger version of Rodney Stark. He maps through history and goes, the world is a different place because of the person of Jesus. And he's writing that probably a bit like Seedentop, as far as I know, not from a kind of religious point of view, which I know is where I come from, not from a Christian religious point of view, but they're coming from a historical point of view. And they go, if you look at the facts, here's the facts, and the world is a different place.
So Jesus, the Game Changer, it's available as a DVD. There's also accompanying study materials. You can even get an app, I understand, if people want to follow along
that way. An outstanding app, and it's free. iTunes or Google Play, just go on, search for Jesus, the Game Changer, and you can download your app for free, which has the whole discussion guide.
Yeah, so something for church groups that want to investigate this stuff. Is this the kind of thing you're hoping might also have interest for skeptics, people who are perhaps considering the person of Jesus?
I think so. I've often said with Towards Belief, and now with this new series, if you're a way out there skeptic and very negative, this probably won't change your mind. But if there are those who are open but aren't not there yet, here is more material to discuss. One of the things that we say about our material is that there's no cringe factor. It's a very high production values. We interview 30 people from around the world. It's beautifully made, beautifully edited, and it's a kind of a journey motif. It's not like, okay, hear me speaking all the time. In fact, you don't see a lot of me at all. But you're kind of journeying through. So how did Jesus change the place of women? Or what was the influence on wealth or democracy? Or why we care for people or education or hospitals? All of those subjects are looked at across the world with outstanding guests.
Jesus, the Game Changer, available now. Do go and check it out at the website, jesusthegamechanger.com. Available wherever you are, of course, via Christian bookshops, outlets and more. But thank you very much for joining me, Carl, on the programme today.
Great to be here, Justin. Thanks.
As ever, if you want to get in touch with today's show, do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget to leave your thoughts via social media at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow the show on Facebook. Look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for being with me today. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. You're unbelievable. Tom Wright joins me in studio to answer your questions. Yes, you can ask NT Wright anything, I said a few weeks ago, and you did send in lots of questions for him. He'll be tackling all kinds of issues from a biblical perspective and accessing that huge brain of his to do so. So I hope you'll enjoy that. Same time, same place next week. Until then, have a good week.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display gentle reading light, and unheard-of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.